From Michigan Radio, this is State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer White. With one in four Michigan kids living in poverty, more pressure is being put on schools to shift the needle for those kids.
Somebody needs to see those kids when they walk in the door as more than a number.
But are we asking schools to do too much? If education is their primary mission, where does everything else at-risk kids need fit in?
I was dealing with not knowing where my family was, being afraid of becoming homeless again.
This hour, we'll look at models that are working for kids. We'll examine Michigan's approach to helping kids from low-income families. And we'll look at what happens when we default to schools as being the places that have all the answers. All that's ahead this hour on State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. You're listening to a special State of Opportunity call-in program from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. One in four Michigan kids live in poverty. While their immediate needs have to be met, we're also faced with the challenge of helping them break the cycle of poverty. The economic and social success of the state depends on it. We want to hear from you. What do you see that isn't being addressed for kids grappling with poverty? What do you think would be the best way to reach these kids and provide support? Join in on the conversation at 866-255-2762 or on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. But first, Camille Tynes is an advocate for foster youth. She's also an alumni of the foster care system. When she was a teenager, her family life was severely disrupted and she needed support.
When I went into the foster care system at 14, that's when it was like, wow, this is crazy, and I don't really have anybody to help navigate me through anything or advocate for me. So, my name is Camille Tynes. I am 23. I feel old, but I'm 23. I am a student at the University of Michigan and at Washtenaw Community College. I was dealing with not knowing where my family was, being afraid of becoming homeless again, what am I going to eat? What's going to happen? Not wanting my friends to know, like so many different things, like besides school stuff was going on in my head. How I coped with everything I was going through was trying to just focus on school. School and church were my two focuses. But there was a point my senior year where everything just became so much that I kind of mentally like checked out. Not because I didn't have it in me, but it was just so overwhelming. I went to Southeastern High School in Detroit. Like, those people there really helped me feel more motivated. I just thought of a couple of teachers. I could see their face in my head. Miss Teresa Lewis, Miss McKenzie. Oh, my gosh. Miss McKenzie, Miss Hawkins, and Lloyd Hogan, Patrice DeBolt. She was like a second mom to everyone. Principal Brenda Gatlin. I know it wasn't easy on them to come out of their own pocket. I would say what really helped me was, one, my personal drive, but, two, being able to find a sense of community through people that supported me. Although my school lacked, I guess you could say, funding at times, and we were in an impoverished neighborhood, being on the southeast side of Detroit, where there's fights, gangs, drug houses right up the block, there still was this sense of community and family. It's like, okay, we know the odds that we're facing. We know this is our current situation, but still, we as a community can succeed.
That was Camille Tynes. She's a student and now advocates for foster youth. And joining us now is Paul Tough, author of How Children Succeed, Great Curiosity and the Hidden Power of Character. He's also the author of Whatever It Takes, an in-depth look at the Harlem Children's Zone. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know, you heard Camille's story. You were listening along with us, and you've spent time with a lot of kids who have faced similar challenges. From your research, what kinds of things have the biggest positive long-term impact for these kids?
Well, I think there are different programs that we can advocate for, that we can introduce, that we can intervene in their lives to help kids like Camille do better. But I think the most important thing to recognize is what Camille was saying, that for her, I think what felt like the big obstacle in her life was much more than just academic. It was about the social situation that she grew up with, the emotional stress that the way that she was living placed on her, and that if we really want to take those things on, we need to find a way to address, you know, not just the academic needs, not even just the physical needs of kids like her, but that we also need to figure out ways to surround them with communities of support like Camille found, and that's harder to do.
In your book, Whatever It Takes, you do a deep dive into the Harlem Children's Zone model. And for listeners who may not be familiar with that program, can you give us a brief description?
Sure. The Harlem Children's Zone is a 97-block neighborhood in central Harlem. And it's also the organization that tries to help kids in that neighborhood. It's run by a man named Jeffrey Canada. It's been around for more than 20 years. And the premise behind the Harlem Children's Zone is that when kids are growing up in deep poverty, like most kids in central Harlem, they face so many obstacles that it doesn't make sense to just focus on one or two and ignore the rest. And so what the Harlem Children's Zone does is provides this comprehensive system of integrated supports, from charter schools to parenting programs to preschools to a farmer's market, a health clinic, with the idea that they're trying to weave together this safety net that will protect kids in that neighborhood from all of the problems and obstacles they face.
Now, you use the term integrative support, and that's different from what we usually see in public schools.
That's right. I mean, mostly, that's not necessarily the fault of public schools. It's the fact that we tend to think of schools as one thing, and we tend to think of social services and social supports as something very different. And, you know, from the way that the federal government administers those programs down to the way that cities and neighborhoods do, we tend to put those in different silos. They're run by different agencies and different departments. And what the Harlem Children's Zone is arguing, really, is that that's not the right approach, because that's not what it feels like to kids. To kids, it feels like this set of problems that they're facing are all connected, and so the solution has to be connected as well.
Now, in the Harlem Children's Zone model, schools are sort of the anchor organization. Is it because it's simply the best place to connect with kids, to sort of capture them?
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree that schools are the anchor. I mean, they're a big part of it, and they do run these two charter schools that go from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade. But I think Jeffrey Canada would argue that all of the other supports that he provides are just as important, and there are a lot of kids in the Harlem Children's Zone who aren't going to those schools, who still use a lot of those services. So schools absolutely are, you know, they've always been a great place to reach kids because young people are there for, you know, much of the day and much of the year. But I think what Jeff is arguing is that alone is never going to be enough.
So if schools aren't the anchor, perhaps an anchor in that model,
yes,
how much emphasis is placed on education as opposed to wraparound services that you're describing?
Well, I think it's really a mix, and certainly education is critical in the Harlem Children's Zone or in any of the other interventions I've seen that seem to work. And one thing we know is that if we want kids to succeed when they're growing up in deep disadvantage, they need a good education. That without getting academic credentials and the kind of knowledge of the world and knowledge of yourself that comes from schooling, it's really difficult to function in the world. It's difficult to function in the workplace. It's difficult to function, you know, in relationships with your family, with the community. And so education is a critical part of it.
So these interventions, they've built, some are for the children, some are for the families. Mm-hmm. What kinds of expectations does the Harlem Children's Zone have of the parents of the kids they serve?
Well, they have a complicated relationship with the parents because, on the one hand, they emphasize that they don't want to use parents as an excuse.
Explain that a little bit when you say an excuse.
I think this is something that some educators feel, you know, that when they get kids and their parents are not engaged, they're not helpful, they're not sort of, doesn't feel like they're on the same team as the teachers and as the educators. I think a lot of educators just sort of throw up their hands and say, you know, there's not much that we can do. And you know, in some ways, if you're working just in a school without any kind of connected supports, I can understand that. I can relate to that because it is very difficult to do that alone as a teacher. But what the Harlem Children's Zone wants to say is that we can't take that approach, that even when parents are completely disengaged, we still need to find a way to help these students succeed. That said, they also recognize that the best way to do that is to have parents who are deeply engaged and deeply connected and who are real partners. And so they do a lot, starting with this parenting program called Baby College that parents go to sometimes before their children are even born. So that's a big part of the early stage of parental involvement. But it continues up through school as well. All of the principals and the teachers work hard to try to make parents feel welcome in schools and make them feel like they're partners in this process of helping their kids succeed.
You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. You can join the conversation at 866-255-2762 or send us a question at the State of Opportunity Facebook page. And we're speaking with Paul Tough, author of How Children Succeed. Paul, as you know, Harlem Children's Zone founder Jeffrey Canada is stepping down, so the organization is undergoing a leadership change right now. But this is a strategic decision on his part because he wants to show that the success of the program isn't personality driven. But at the same time, there have been attempts to launch this model in other places, including Detroit. Those were called Promise Zones, but they haven't been able to really replicate the same level of success. What do you think is the key to why this model has been successful in Harlem?
Well, I have to say, I think a lot of it comes down to money. I don't think that money alone is the answer to problems in disadvantaged neighborhoods. But the fact is, you know, the Harlem Children's Zone budget is, I think, $75 million a year. And they spend about $3,000 per child per year on top of what they spend in schools. And that, you know, Jeff makes a really coherent case for why that is the right amount to spend and why it's actually a great investment. But that is not the kind of resources that most attempts to replicate the Harlem Children's Zone have had. When Senator Barack Obama first proposed replicating the Harlem Children's Zone through his Promise Neighborhoods program way back when he was a presidential candidate in 2007, he talked about how it would be necessary to spend billions of dollars a year on this program. He really portrayed it as something that would redefine the way the government helped poor kids in mostly in urban neighborhoods. And I think that was exactly right. But then when he became president, for you know reasons that are complicated, he wasn't able to do that. And I think both in terms of what he requested from Congress and what Congress gave him, there hasn't been enough money to make that work. And so I think a lot of these Promise Neighborhood replications have struggled as a result.
You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. Still to come, we'll continue our conversation with Paul Tough. We'll also talk to John Covington, the man heading up the Education Achievement Authority, Michigan's district for the lowest performing schools in Detroit. And as always, we want to hear from you at 866-255-2762 or on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. What do you see that isn't being addressed for kids dealing with poverty or other issues? You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. The 1 in 4 kids in Michigan who live in poverty need a path out. We often default to schools to provide many of the answers, but is that the right approach? Amber Arellano is Executive Director of Education Trust Midwest. They recently released a report that showed Michigan schools and students falling behind other states.
What we see in places like Massachusetts, you know, where they start from is not where do we have the votes, or what does this PAC say about this topic, or what does the special interest group say about this topic. Where they start is from, okay, what do we need to do better by our schools and our kids? We're at a really fragile moment for public education in Michigan, and the next couple of years are going to be really, really important, particularly for vulnerable kids, for low-income communities. I mean, as we begin a conversation about school funding, there's more and more conversation in Lansing about school funding and what makes sense for all of our students. Equity has to be a part of that.
That was Amber Arellano, Director of Education Trust Midwest. Still with us is author Paul Tough, and joining us now is John Covington, Chancellor of the Education Achievement Authority, which oversees 15 of Detroit's lowest performing schools. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate being here.
So you heard Amber's comments, and you're on the ground. Do you agree about the fragility of the state of Michigan's education right now?
Well, not only do I agree with what was being said about the fragility of the state of Michigan's public schools, but if you look across the length and breadth of the nation, I think that you would find that reality is just as true in a lot of the other states, if not most other states. And I find that the problem with public schooling, not necessarily in Detroit or the state of Michigan, but throughout the country, is that we are continuing to maintain a system of public schooling that we should have long since abandoned, and a system that is certainly no longer applicable for 21st century digital native young people who exit their mother's womb with a cell phone in one hand and an iPod in the other. And it just doesn't make sense. And so in the Education Achievement Authority, we have adopted as a mission, as a result of our basic philosophical belief in that this country should have long since abandoned its traditional model of education. We say that we use the EAA as a vehicle, if you will, to disrupt traditional public schooling and provide an innovative and a creative approach to 21st century teaching and learning that not only can be used and replicated by other school districts throughout the state, but perhaps even throughout the nation.
As you know, I don't have to tell you, the EAA has been highly controversial. There are critics and detractors, but I think many people also don't really understand the model you're using in the EAA. So describe in a little more detail what you're doing to, as you described it, disrupt.
Right. A great question. And one of the things that first of all, when you consider the fact that we are taking the persistently lowest achieving schools, and you said in the state, I'm sorry, in the city of Detroit, which is true, but the 15 schools that we acquired are not only the lowest achieving schools in the city of Detroit, but also throughout the entire state, where children are coming to us with egregious levels of failure, where they have performed at 0 in some cases, 2% in some cases, 7% in other cases, proficient on a statewide achievement exam. And then when you look at where they are in terms of their own cognitive ability and their learning, they're 3 or more levels below where they should be. And so what do we do in the EAA to serve as a disruption to traditional public schooling? The first thing we have done is we've changed the school calendar. Our first day of school is September the 4th. Our last day of school is August the 6th, and that doesn't include like our summer session. First day of school, September 4th. Last day of school is August the 6th. We have eliminated traditional grade levels, first grade, second grade, third grade, so forth and so on, and we have developed local curriculum frameworks that's not only tightly aligned to Michigan model content standards, but to the Common Core, which are national standards, and international standards as well. That's vitally important for our young people because we believe that in a world that's highly competitive, and certainly in a world that's been made small by technology, that young people are no longer being called upon to compete against children in neighboring school districts or in neighboring states. They're being called upon to compete against children worldwide. And so as a result of having these instructional levels that's developed or from the frameworks, children now progress through these instructional levels based on whenever they demonstrate that they have mastered the requisite skill that they need to have to be successful at the next level of their learning, rather than progress through superficial grade levels based on the amount of time that they sit in the seat. That old system that says you go to school for 9 months and you get promoted to the next grade. Our kids are so savvy and they are so smart that a lot of them have come to realize over the years that guess what? I can, although I'm supposed to go to school for 9 months, I can miss half those days, and at the end of the year, I'm still going to get promoted to the next grade.
It sounds to me as if you're facing two challenges. You have a high quality education you're trying to provide for kids, but as Paul and I were speaking about earlier, there are also some issues kids are facing as a result of living in deep poverty. How much do those issues impact your ability to provide a high education, a high level education?
Well, first of all, when you consider the fact that we have changed the approach and our system is now based on mastery, where students, to a large extent, take ownership in cooperation with their teachers, take ownership for their own learning, and they progress through the system based on mastery rather than superficial seat time. That works better for the children that we serve. Now, it is certainly true that a lot of our children, and I say a lot, the vast majority of our children are coming from socioeconomically deprived backgrounds that really pose some big hurdles that we have to overcome and obstacles as well. But we can't as Paul said about the Harlem Children's Zone and Jeffrey Canada's philosophy, we also have as a basic belief that we can't hold children accountable and or responsible for who their parents are or what zip code they live in. And so while we can't do everything, we don't have the resources, nor in some cases the skill sets to provide some of these other services, wraparound services that children need. But that doesn't allow us a free pass, and nor does it allow us to abdicate our responsibility to partner with law enforcement officials, Department of Social and Human Services, healthcare systems, the employment office, colleges and universities, juvenile assessment center, Black Family Development, to make sure that separate and apart from those things that we can't do, we do have viable partners within the community that we reach out to that help us provide the services to young people that they need so that they can, to the greatest extent possible, can navigate through the problems of having been born at no fault of their own in poverty.
We're speaking with John Covington, Chancellor of the Education Achievement Authority, and author Paul Tough. Paul, the Harlem Children's Zone sets very high expectations for the kids in their program, and they're pretty unmovable on those expectations. But do those expectations discount the fact that, just as John has just described, these kids are facing very serious issues outside of the classroom?
Well, Jeffrey Canada's goal is to have all of his students either graduate from college or be prepared to graduate from college. If they you know, are ready for college but choose not to, he can handle that. But he wants most of them to graduate from four-year colleges. And so, obviously, that's a huge challenge in neighborhoods like Central Harlem where there isn't a Harlem Children's Zone. Four-year college graduation rates are often in the single digits. But what Jeff argues, and what I think is true about the Harlem Children's Zone, is that it is possible to get kids from neighborhoods like that to high levels of academic success, including college graduation, but only if you do a lot more than just give them great schools. That giving them great schools is certainly a part of that, but that you've got to go well beyond that and provide this comprehensive system of support. If you do that, then you can hold them to those high expectations.
John, with the understanding that the EAA doesn't have access to the same level of resources as, say, a Harlem Children's Zone, talk about your expectations for the kids in the EAA.
Oh, sure. Within the Education Achievement Authority, the 15 schools that we have, and in any school that we will acquire in the future, there is the expectation that although children are coming to us as low achievers, many of them two or more grade levels behind, that we will meet them where they are, with the understanding that in working with their teachers, having removed some of the barriers that's present that have precluded adequate kind of progress in school based on the current traditional structure of public schools, that children will achieve 1.5 to 2 years growth in a year. And one of the ways in which we ensure maximum success in achieving that goal is we have removed this one-size-fits-all approach to teaching and learning, and we have provided every child with what we call an individualized learning or an individualized education plan that's tailored to their unique and diverse needs. So as children then begin to progress through their school experience, they're getting what they need when they need it, despite what their peers in their classrooms may demonstrate that they need.
You mentioned the fact that you don't have access to the same resources as the Harlem Children's Zone. So with that understanding, what are your expectations of the EAA as a turnaround district? Do you think those expectations are reasonable?
Well, most think that we have a huge sum of money that we get to carry out the or to operate the schools that we have, and that's certainly not true. We have learned that while, and I'm not going to say that money, that additional money wouldn't be good, and I would agree with Jeffrey Canada that the $3,000 that he is able to spend over and beyond his per pupil allocation is certainly the right thing to do. While we don't have access to those resources, what we do is to make sure that within every opportunity that we have is to spend the education dollars that we get to educate children wisely. And so we have to rely on, first of all, our state allocation, our federal allocation, and then any grants that we're able to write and win, because we don't get the local tax base. But our system can be certainly carried out within the allocations that I just spoke about, with, in some cases, outside support coming from philanthropic and organizations and individuals, not only within the state, but outside the state as well.
You know, when we look
for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we're the only school district in the country that successfully won that grant 3 years in a row. And that's certainly a big help to us as we carry out the innovative and creative approaches to teaching and learning that we work to carry out each day.
When we look at education policies at a state level, like here in Michigan and nationally as well, have we allowed ourselves to become complacent and to pass off some of these issues as being about other people's children? Paul, I'll come to you first.
I think absolutely. I think that many of us who don't live in neighborhoods of deep disadvantage tend to think that what's going on there is very distant from us. And I think the way that we, from a government point of view, the way that we deal with those problems reflects that. You know, that we think starting at the first day of kindergarten is soon enough, that we don't need to do anything beyond that. And I think that you know, in other neighborhoods, the way we think about our kids and what they need, we go far beyond that. You know, I'm the father of a four-year-old, and when I think about everything that I've done for the past 4 years to try to get him ready for kindergarten, I know that that's not happening in a lot of neighborhoods, and I think it should. You know, I don't think that my son really deserves any advantages over the other incoming kindergarten kids. But I think the reality is that you know, who I am in the neighborhood I live in, I've been able to give him this leg up, and I actually think that's not fair. And I think that all of us need to think about how we're providing a structure of support for kids that goes beyond a system where every family is just in charge of their own kids. We take care of our own, and we don't worry about the kids down the block or the kids across town.
John, how much of what you're facing in the EAA do you think is a result of this issue of, these aren't my kids, these are other people's children?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm going to have to go back to, in terms of where children are in school, I can't deny that their backgrounds in some cases contribute to the lack of proficiency in terms of where they are in school. But I would also have to say that we can't use as an excuse that these aren't our children. These young people are coming from the worst possible environments that you can humanly conceive. And so we have to face our own reality and understand that in many cases, these children are not going to get it at home. They're not going to get it in the communities in which they live. And if we don't somehow provide what they need to somehow transform themselves and turn the tiny sparks of possibilities within them into open flames of achievement, if they don't get that from us, they quite frankly are not going to get it. And then we continue to be guilty, if you will, of creating, maintaining the from school to prison pipeline.
Paul, we heard from Kathleen Cunningham on Facebook. She says you can't improve children's lives without raising the state of families and neighborhoods. How much of this is about moving outside of the classroom and really making more of an effort to strengthen the neighborhoods and communities around these schools?
I think it's a big part of it, and I think that neighborhoods are the right way to think about the problem. It's one of the things that I like about the Harlem Children's Zone is it's taking, you know, a 97-block neighborhood. That's pretty big. It's very ambitious, but it's not, you know, Jeffrey Kennedy's not saying I'm going to improve things for every child in the country, you know. He hopes to get there eventually, but he started, you know, with one block, then that expanded to 10, then that expanded to 24, and then to 97, and I think that is, you know, a neighborhood is a very important institution for kids. That's where they spend all their time. The influence of the neighborhood. You know, we know from looking at economics and looking at and, you know, neuroscience studies, where you live, the neighborhood you live in has a huge effect on how you develop. But right now, we don't have a lot of great strategies to improve neighborhoods. We have some, but I don't think that we tend to think about that, and we certainly don't think about it in an educational context. That, you know, if we want to help a school succeed, we need to improve things in the neighborhood around it. But I think it's exactly the right approach.
John, in just the final 10 seconds that we have here, talk a little bit about that neighborhood piece and how important that is to the success you think you can accomplish in the EAA.
I think the neighborhood piece is certainly vitally important. And one of the things I like to say is it's while the schools can't do it all, and I think even if we had Jeffrey Canada online, he would say that his success hasn't necessarily been based on what he's been able to do in the Harlem Children's Zone, but the manner in which social service agencies and other agencies within the community came together in a spirit of cooperation to work together to get this done. So we're going to have to stop working in silos and pool resources, pool initiatives and pool effort, those kinds of things coming together to make it better for children.
We've been speaking
and families.
We've been speaking with John Covington, Chancellor of the EAA, and author Paul Tough. Thank you to you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Still ahead, there are people on the ground working with at-risk kids every day. What do they see working? You're listening to a special State of Opportunity call-in show from Michigan Radio. There's still time for you to join the conversation at 866-255-2762 or on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. Many schools step up to provide critical safety net services to kids who are struggling. To meet the needs of many of their students at the Detroit Lions Academy, that's part of the Detroit Public Schools, they get resources in the form of extra staff from a nonprofit group that tries to address some of those needs.
You know, I would say one of the key factors in being able to deliver this work and do it the right way is really what we've always considered to be one of the basics that all kids need, whether they be low income or not, and that's a one-on-one relationship with a caring adult.
My name is Deron Wells. We're here at Detroit Lions Alternative School. We are affiliated with Detroit Lions. I'm the director here. It is an alternative school, so although we're 6th through 8th grade, we do have kids here between the ages of 12 to maybe 16, sometimes even 17. Some of the kids have been placed here because they had problems at other schools, but there's also kids that are placed here because we have additional services to help them. And they may be overage, but they're overage because they didn't receive the resources that they needed.
Leon Moorhead, Project Director, Communities and Schools, Metro Detroit. Basically, Communities and Schools is trying to help stop the dropout rate. Today, my job is to be that caring adult that you'll have a one-on-one relationship with. Because of the neighborhood moving away or the local school closing, you don't have some of the stabilizing forces. So Communities and Schools is trying to be the stabilizing force. We want to be able to be that person that you can come and say, I need to talk to you, I need some help. Or whether there's a health issue, we need to try and find you some dental care or some vision issues.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Good to see you. The good part about having a relationship with kids is, you know, they know they can tell me almost anything. Like, they just told me some kids that was been smoking some marijuana. We kept going, so.
You know, schools are certainly asked to do an awful lot of stuff. And once you've determined that having services available in schools is a good idea, then the question becomes, well, who should be doing that and how should that be done?
That was Jeff Brown with Communities and Schools. We also heard from staff and students at Detroit Lions Academy. So what do we see working? Joining us now is Carl King, an education consultant and reading interventionist. Carl, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
So you listened to that piece of audio we just played. Mm-hmm. How much does that reflect the reality of some of the challenges you see kids facing?
That's a real reality. That's a real reality. Many of the young people that I face and deal with are dealing with issues that seem to be bigger, more paramount to education than they should be. Some of the environmental constraints, some of the things that happen in the neighborhood seem to get in the way of education. So as many programs are needed as possible. But I think, too, that we've got to listen to your earlier guests, and they're talking about the education model. But the education model would be, I think, a little stronger if we had teachers and other folk who were actually equipped to deal with some of the issues that they're dealing with.
What kind of training or additional support do teachers and administrators need to do what you're talking about?
Well, for instance, and you and I talked a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. we talked about the cell phone issue and how the cell phones, especially at the high school level, seem to be one of the biggest distractions that I've ever encountered in dealing with young people. Those cell phones seem to take away from their actual knowledge. Their attention is on the cell phone. And now you've got folk who are actually using the cell phone as a part of their curriculum. But again, those young people get an opportunity to go into things that they actually should not be into. And that cell phone is actually blocking their learning. Hmm.
Let's talk to Leah in Grand Rapids. Leah, welcome to the program. Did you have a question?
Yes. Not really a question, just a statement about the work that we're doing here in Grand Rapids with GRPS, the public school system, and Parent University. We have constructed our own virtual university for parents to help them become confident advocates of their children's academic success. And the more I work on this committee, the more I see that it is based on relationships. We have to develop relationships with our parents, our teachers, our administrators, even the secretaries and janitors at the school. The whole community has to be involved in the child's life. You know, as the old adage says, it takes a village to raise a child. I think sometimes we continue to pile things onto schools and teachers and the school system to do and to solve, and we forget that we have a whole community that we can go to and, you know, get this part of it from this person, you know, just like a good old-fashioned potluck. There's one person that makes the phone calls and gets the meals together. Somebody else goes to pick up the chicken. And, you know, I think that's the part that we've gotten away from, that whole community thing, and reaching out to get help, receive help, offer help in the children's lives in a whole encompassing way. And in Grand Rapids, I'm proud to be a part of this initiative, GR Parent University, and I'm hoping to see it develop into a whole community effort in helping our children.
Leah, thank you so much for the call.
Mm-hmm.
And that reflects something we received from Monica from Tompkins. She says schools versus wraparound services, this is from Facebook, doesn't really express the child's need for belonging. If the children feel connected deeply over time, that will provide them with a reasonably effective safety net to help children whose families are not supportive for their ability to thrive. So there's this ongoing theme of creating community where community may be absent.
Mm-hmm. No question about it. We're all partners. We're all partners in this. And in my opinion, and just dealing in the schools that I deal with in the Detroit area, I just don't think the teachers are adequately equipped to deal with some of those issues. The subcultures, and you and I talked about this mm-hmm. in the past, to bring in those subcultures, bring trust. It brings those different feelings from the student to let them know that they really do. And they really do have my back. Mm-hmm. They're really concerned about me. If you think about it, if you go to a foreign country, some of the things that you learn before you go to the country is so the country can actually appreciate you being there. And then they'll start sharing what goes on in their culture. Well, it happens at the school level as well. And when you are familiar at least with their subculture, and nobody's asking anybody from suburbia to act hip if they come into urban school or vice versa. That's not what we're talking about. But what we are talking about is just being aware of where they're from, what they're going through, and actually using that as a piece to educate them. And then you'll grab them, in our opinion. You will grab them, and they will trust the process. Mm-hmm. But if you're asking them to leave everything away, and then they go to an environment that tells them that school is not a good thing, then now it's a lot of pressure on young people. And
that, that's basically what I'm saying. Being pulled in a lot of
different directions. Yeah, they're pulled in a lot of different directions.
You know, we use these terms, at risk, vulnerable, kids who are growing up in poverty. But that sort of removes the face from these young people.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Tell us about the kids you work with. Who are they? What do they want? What do they aspire to?
They aspire to the same things any other young people do. I mean, they all want to be great. They've ran into some conditional things that sometimes get in the way. Many, especially when I'm doing my reading piece, many of them at the high school level, they have basic reading skills issues. Reading issues that nobody dealt with before they got to this level. And again, adequate training for the teachers. In my opinion, I just think from K through 12, teachers all should be trained in how to teach basic reading skills. Because once you get them there, I have a young man I'm working with in one of the after school programs that I work. Once you explain things to him comprehension wise, he gets it. Mm. But the issue is he doesn't have the basic reading skills. Now he's a junior. So what's going to happen to him once he graduates? And I didn't hear your two speakers before me. I didn't hear either one of them address that. We are actually setting them up for failure when they don't have the basic skills to compete. And that reading piece is very, very valuable. In my experiences, I'm finding not only the young people that went through the juvenile system, because I work with young people there as well, but just typical young people, they don't have the reading skills to actually master what they need to master at the high school level. When I used to be director of admissions for Lewis College of Business. It was the last historically black college in the state. And we would recruit these students from not just DPS, from the Oakland County District, you know, the different districts that surround. And they would come in and take a simple compass test. And that compass test is not equivalent to the ACT or the SAT. It's just a compass exam. Mm-hmm. And their math skills and they just walked across the stage. So their math skills is at a fourth grade. Their reading skills is at a third grade. But they have a high school diploma. The parents didn't celebrate it. Everybody had a good time at the graduation. But as a reality, they're not ready to compete. So what's going to happen to those young people?
Well, we heard John Covington refer to the prison pipeline, mm-hmm. and that seems to be a real risk for these young people if they walk away either without the diploma or with the diploma and they're still not able to function mm-hmm. at the level they need to. That's a real pathway for them.
It is. The reality is that investors in the prison industry, they look at their second and third grade reading scores and start investing in the prisons. So with that being said, I would think that the schools would actually embrace having everybody trained. I mean, peer pro, everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody that's going to put a hand on that child or talk to that child, everybody should be trained in how to get at least the basic reading skills. Because what happens is as they get older, sometimes even at the high school level, in the beginning of the school year, some of my students don't want to come to the reading program because of the stigma of I can't read. Mm-hmm. But in the end, once they stay with it, now all of a sudden they can read. So then you see all these different changes in them, positivity.
As the confidence grows.
As the confidence grows. And school at that point is not a place where they don't want to be. School becomes a place where they want to be.
You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. There's still time for you to join the conversation at 866-255-2762 or on our State of Opportunity Facebook page. We heard from one Facebook commenter who says, my husband came from a poverty and crime background. It was not the schools that saved him, but instead the church and sports. He constantly reminds me of one teacher who took him aside and helped him with his reading. Where he was struggling from neglect in the classroom, it didn't take a lot for one teacher to really reach out and make a difference for his ability to do okay in school. And we've heard this as a recurring theme over the course of this project, that sometimes it just takes one adult, not necessarily even a teacher, maybe it's a pastor mm-hmm. or a community member, mm-hmm. to reach out and anchor these kids. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And has that been your experience?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's always the case. But the problem with that is, and I totally agree with the person who wrote that, but how do we get to the masses? Mm. See, now we're just talking twos and fews. And twos and fews is great, but we're about the masses. Let's get the masses of young people reading. Let's get the masses of young people understanding how to navigate through those issues that can confront them environmentally.
And that's why we end up in schools, because that's where we can capture
kids. That's where we can capture them. If it's just a strong after-school program, which I'm really happy to be a part of a couple of them, But we're not getting the masses of kids that we actually should get through those programs. And, of course, the programs have to go through fighting for funding and those types of things. But we need to get those masses of young people, and that is in the schools.
Some people listening may be thinking, well, where are the parents, and where is the responsibility for parents? And, you know, when we look at poverty statistics, we see this cycle where a family gets locked into poverty. Have you come across parents who perhaps were disengaged because they also had a negative experience in school?
No, I think that's the biggest issue. I really do. But we have to integrate things that will almost mandate. Because the parents, some of those types of parents who had bad experiences in school, they need training too. There's no question about it. We just need them to want to be trained. We need them to want to have their young people at another level.
So how do we bridge that gap? How do we do that?
Well, you know, some districts are actually fining parents who are not involved. And they've been rather successful with the fines. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that, but what I am saying is there's a number of things out there that we could do to pull parents into the process. We need them on board, because what happens is young people, they get all of the school, all this energy from school and after school programs, and then they go home, and that parent has actually more pull on them than anybody else. So once the parent has that pull, then they change the mind of all that work that was just done by educators. Mm. So we need them on board. There's no question about that. If we want the masses, we need them on board. Those parents are vital. They're vital.
And that feeds into what we heard from Kristen Elizabeth. She's an eighth grade social studies teacher in Plymouth. And she says, schools are not magic. Teachers are not magicians. Mm-hmm. I can't afford supplies for all my students, much less address the deeper social needs.
Well, I think some of the deeper social needs, well, I totally agree with her. Well, I don't totally agree with her. I agree with her. But at the same time, I think teachers need to be retrained as well. And what I mean is this. These young people need defense mechanisms. They need to know how to navigate and stay away from these things that we want them to stay away from. Well, if the teacher or the school has them the majority of the day, then they have to be the ones trained to teach them how to navigate through those things. That's just a reality.
Is it just training, or do you think, from your observation, that it's training and resources?
I think it's training, resources, and it's got to be a want on the teacher's end, too. Teachers are prepared to come in and make scholars out of students, and that's a beautiful thing. They're not necessarily prepared to come in and deal with the behaviors and the disrespect and some of the things that students bring. The students bring them many times because, again, at home, education is not a viable resource for them. It's not something that's held in high esteem. And many times the parents come, unfortunately, not the masses, because I'm a parent as well. You met my children.
Yeah.
They're out in the other studio. But many times the parents have an adversarial relationship with teachers for whatever reason. And a lot of times, and I'm glad you brought up that other point, because, again, when I was at Lewis College of Business, I had parents come in who actually told me, Mr. King, my son probably won't do good in math because I wasn't good in math. So they think it's inherited. And so that's what I mean by the reteaching of parents, the retraining of parents, getting them to understand, yes, you might not have had a great school experience. However, your young person, your son, your daughter is going to do a phenomenal job, and we're going to make sure of that.
You know, as I hear you describing some of these challenges, and we have just about a minute left, it sounds overwhelming in some ways. You talk about reaching the masses. For people who are listening right now who are saying, okay, well, what can I do? If there's something I can do as an individual, I'm not a teacher, I'm not an administrator, what can I do? What would you say?
I would say if you can just grab one, two, three young people, get them to understand the connection between professionalism, between careers, and actually between school. You know, career day is a great thing, but it's nothing like actually taking a young person to a courtroom, taking them to a police station, taking them to an attorney's office, taking them to these places and then getting them to understand the math, the reading, everything that goes into them doing what they do.
Carl King is an education consultant and reading interventionist. Carl, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jen.
You've been listening to a special State of Opportunity call-in show from Michigan Radio. You can continue the conversation on Facebook. Just search for State of Opportunity. State of Opportunity was produced and directed by Sarah Alvarez and Allie Billings with help from Kimberly Springer. The program was engineered by Bob Scon.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.